Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Roerink, Jack Spencer, Mike Malott. A little later, Senator David Kinesic will be our guest. He'll talk about what happened on primary election day and the reaction he's received since then. But first, guys, let's talk about what we're seeing on the governor's race. And John, we're starting to see that the Bill Schuette campaign is trying to chip into this presumed lead that Gretchen Whitmer has, bringing up a few different issues that are trying to paint Gretchen Whitmer as the most liberal senator that there's ever been in the state of Michigan. I just want to say, before I hand this over to you, I took a look at our old MERS rankings of where Gretchen Whitmer has been. I'm sorry, she's always been in the middle of the pack. There's one time she kind of waffled near being among the most liberal senators, but according to our rankings, she's never been the most liberal senator.
No, she's not one of the most liberal senators. But one of my points is, and I've said, and I still think she's got history on her side. I still think she's got a natural built-in advantage because of the excitement on the Democratic side, and I think she's got the momentum on her side, her party's side. But the one thing I do think that she should be concerned about is that videotape of the ICE statement. Now, granted, she has refuted that in front of traditional reporters in a scrum, but the fact of the matter is it's out there. It's something that you can put in a message ad and that you can beat her over the head over and over and over again. And if there's a turn of events where national security or immigration becomes the predominant issue in the fall election, going into the fall election, it could damage her chances. I'm not saying she would lose over it necessarily, but I think there's enough people in the middle who view the stance or even the smell of someone who wants to do away with law enforcement of our immigration system, do away with ICE, is something they can't support and wouldn't support.
Okay, so for our listeners' benefit, if they haven't seen the video yet, this is a tracker who appears to have shown up at some progressive rally right by the Capitol, and he just blurts out and persistently asks Gretchen Whitmer whether we should eliminate ICE. She gives a non-answer for the most part through this snippet, and that at the end she nods her head yes to the question about whether they should eliminate...
Play the audio. There's a little more to it than that, I think.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and play the audio. Let the listeners decide.
Gretchen, do you think we should abolish ICE?
I think we need a governor who's going to stand up to the federal government when they're violating our rights.
Do you think we should abolish ICE, though?
I think that ICE is doing a fundamentally cruel and unconstitutional and undemocratic.
So you think we should abolish it?
I think our governor needs to stand up.
We should abolish ICE, do you think? Thank you, ma'am.
She said yes, the governor needs to stand up. She never said yes, we should abolish ICE. That's when she nodded her head. I mean, to me, that doesn't sound like a clear-cut yes to me. Jack, what do you think?
I thought it looked like she said yes, or it comes across to me like she was responding to the guy.
Mike, what do you think?
I think she answers yes.
Okay, so
I think in an attack ad, you put that image up there, and it's going to be clipped a lot more than what we played because you're going to lose the intro part. You're going to hear the I think they're doing an unconstitutional, cruel, and should they be abolished? Yeah, that's where it's going to end, and you can put that in a messaging ad on TV and on the radio and over and over again, and it's going to impact the middle voter. It's going to impact the independent voter. It's going to impact some moderate Republicans who are probably going to vote for her anyways, given just the history. And the time we are in right now.
Now, she told me in an interview shortly thereafter that she does not support the elimination of ICE. But you're saying the perception...
It doesn't matter. That message right there, if it's delivered the right way over and over again, can impact the middle of the vote. I'm not saying she doesn't.
Okay.
But what I'm saying is there's a problem there that she should be concerned about.
Jack, do you agree?
I think that it's a problem. I don't think it's a problem if her opponents and if the Republicans take somebody's advice and say we're only going to stick to state issues. But my contention has been for a while that the Republicans are going to benefit if they are smart enough to nationalize the election more. And I know that's counterintuitive with all the stuff about Trump, blah, 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 who, by the way, I think we'd be better off measuring his standing with people less on asking whether they favor him and more on asking how much they hate his opponents. I think that has more to do with how he ends up winning with 10% more in 2016 than what he actually was polling.
See, that is counterintuitive because we've been hearing that Republicans don't want to nationalize this election because then it does become about Trump, and Trump's popularity is in the toilet among independents.
I think if the Republicans were doing peachy keen and fine at the state level, then okay, don't bother doing it. But I don't think they are doing peachy keen and fine at the state level. And I think by nationalizing, if it's on the right issue, and I think the right issue is immigration, which polls just astronomically, if you've ever seen the polling on the immigration question, I think that's basically going to be the Republicans' best bet, is to nationalize it. People at home get them all mixed up. Half the time they're calling their local reps or their local senator and complaining about national things anyway, and they don't really make that much of a distinction.
I don't know why you would think it would be good for the Republicans to just focus on state issues. I mean, let's just talk about it for a minute. Flint, you got the unemployment insurance agency debacle where computers are fining people for fraud that didn't commit fraud. You've got PFAS. You've got the water issue. You've got the roads. You've got
a great economy, though, John. The economy's good, and the state's got a great balance.
This is about managing state government. You've got the audit that came out last week about Child Protective Services. I mean, you can make an argument that on every management level, there's questions that can be raised and hit over the head of the Republicans about the conduct of state government. Why would you make it about state government?
Well, is the state not in better shape today than it was 8 years ago?
So too is the country, is what the Democrats would respond, I assume, is, you know, country's economy, so goes Michigan's economy.
Mike, what do you think of this?
Republicans could indeed make some headway by nationalizing the issues. If Whitmer's smart, she's going to bring it back to the state issues. In the governor's role, she'll have absolutely nothing to do with immigration. So she stays on state issues, and there are a lot of state issues that she can pound the Republicans with.
Jack, but when you take a look at maybe some of the bigger issues that are polling well right now, roads, auto insurance. Those seem to be the two that are polling the best. Is it advantageous for him to come out with plans on both, on how to fix roads, how to address auto insurance rates, and get Gretchen Whitmer to debate on that, and to get her to say, how is she going to pay to fix the damn roads? Because I don't know if that's ever really been made crystal clear.
Oh, I think he has to have his white paper on all of these issues, and he has to talk about them, and he has to make a distinction between himself and the fact that the last 8 years the Republicans have controlled everything. Mm-hmm. But again, on the nationalization of things, the problem the Dems have on that stuff is they've got this split in their base between the traditionalist blue-collar Democratic people and the progressives. And when you start hitting a couple of these national issues, now you're starting to cause problems with the candidates you're up against, and they've got to figure out how to answer and please both sides of a question.
See, and this is why I'm talking about the state issues here, John, just to push back a little bit, because auto insurance is one item that the Republicans have not been able to tackle since they've been in control for 8 years. Mm-hmm. And couldn't that be an issue that Bill Schuette hits Gretchen Whitmer on? Look, Gretchen Whitmer doesn't even support Mike Duggan's plan on auto insurance reform. He's probably closer to Mike Duggan on auto insurance than she is. And nothing has gotten done. And you could make the argument it's because of the Democrats.
Well, who's had control is my response, or Whitmer's response should be, who had control? I mean, the Republicans had control of the House and Senate and the governor's office. They didn't solve it. Now, we're going to blame Gretchen Whitmer, who's been out of office for, what, 4 years now? Really?
Yeah, I just think it's an awful hard argument to make. Look, you know, we've been in control for 8 years, but now I'm going to come in and continue Republican control. I'm going to fix things that we couldn't agree on, you know, in the last 8 years.
But is the better argument talking about Hamas and whether Garland Gilchrist, back in 2009 in his radio program, seemed to be sympathetic to Hamas? How does that play with folks?
I think that's a harder line to draw than replaying her ICE video. You can kind of try to tie the two together, I suppose. And if you're the Republicans, you could also probably dig up some past statements or actions by Dana Nessel and make an argument the entire ticket is too far to the left. Just his case, just the Hamas question, the tweets, I think is going to be a hard one just to hang on.
I mean, because we could go on the Wayback Machine and find all sorts of stuff on Bill Schuette if we wanted to. We could go back to his past support for capital punishment, for example. I mean, we could bring that out there.
He's been a politician so long, he might be able to find contradictive things that he said one time or another. But the bottom line, as I said before, I think in another state where the red side's doing better, Kansas or someplace like that, okay, maybe you don't want to jump to the national level. Maybe there's not a reason to. But I just don't see what the Republicans have going for them, especially with the history of Michigan, et cetera, with the natural pendulum swinging back. I think they have a better chance if they go national, when national issues.
We had some information shared with us earlier today, John, from our Capitol correspondent, who claims that a source indicates that Donald Trump will come to Michigan two times between now and the election. Do you believe it?
Of course.
Because our Capitol correspondent said so. Absolutely. So why would we not believe? Absolutely. I believe that he's heard that. But will Trump really do it? I mean, it seems like the only person who really knows is Donald Trump, right? He's the only one who knows.
He's the only person who knows, and he may not even know. But he likes this stuff. I mean, clearly, I mean, you've seen him. He's doing a rally just about once a week now. He likes this stuff. So I wouldn't be surprised.
Jack, if you were the consultant and Donald Trump comes in and says, I'm coming to Michigan, where do you put Donald Trump?
Well, first of all, Macomb County. I mean, you're crazy if you don't put him there. I would think he'd want to try to bring out the blue-collar Dems, which I still think in Michigan, if all the Dems show up, if all the Republicans show up, the Dems win.
Okay, so unless that's the first spot.
So you have to get, I still think you have to get some blue-collar Dems, a lot of blue-collar Dems to switch sides. But the next place, someplace up north, someplace good. I don't know. He's picked some pretty odd places in the past, so who knows?
Northern Michigan. I thought Cadillac is far enough north and still a larger city. What about Muskegon? Muskegon's a possibility, too, because that's kind of on the cusp. I mean, that's the Republicans seem to be doing okay still in Muskegon.
If you get someplace closer to Lansing so MERS can have a shorter drive to get there.
That would be helpful.
Delta Township? He doesn't want to go to Delta Township. Where did he had a rally south of town? The Summit. Wasn't he at the Summit?
Yeah. Where was it the first time? Weberville? Well, I'm trying to remember the little town he went to the first time.
No, it wasn't Weberville. No, it was Potterville. It was at the Summit.
Okay.
That's where he was. Right. Do you agree, Mike? Where would you tell Donald Trump to go? UP?
I was thinking Grand Rapids area.
Well, he could.
You got a lot of conservatives over in that area, and many of them still are hardcore in favor of Donald Trump.
Donald Trump doesn't seem to be doing well. Republican candidates don't seem to be doing as well in Grand Rapids as they have been in the past. Winnie Brinks is doing really well over there, but Justin Amash might need his help, but he's not a big fan of Justin Amash, and Justin Amash isn't a big fan of him, so yeah, I don't know. I'm going to stick with Muskegon, that or Cadillac.
Maybe he'll try to help Lena Epstein, who was his co-chair.
Ooh. Could you imagine? I think that might actually hurt her, though. I think she's trying to separate from Trump. That's going to be a real hard thing to do.
I think it's real hard. As a matter of fact, I wouldn't even advise it because I just don't think Republicans can thread that needle. You can't say I was for him all this time, then suddenly separate yourself. I think either live or die with it.
All right. Well, let's proceed then with our interview with David Kanisky.
Okay, you don't want to say that you're giving up right now. Just hold your ground and don't give up in what you believe. Big plans, big crash. I'll be different when you can't be yourself. Big plans, big crash. I'll be different when you can't be yourself.
All right, joining me this week for the podcast is Senator David Kanisik. Senator, thanks for joining us on the podcast this week.
My pleasure.
All right, well, how difficult has it been coming back to the Capitol after what happened in the primary where you surprisingly got punked in your primary election?
Yeah, I've never talked to more people who speak to me as if I've died. You know, to my face, you know, every conversation, you know, I'll say...
We should be mourning, right?
Yeah. I'll say to folks, like, how are you doing? And they'll go, oh, I'm good, David. And then there's this pregnant pause, and they go... But how are you doing? You know, so it's been a consistent conversation.
As if you've been diagnosed with terminal cancer or something.
Yeah, it's been, I think, funny, for lack of a better word. It's been pretty funny.
Okay, so the first question out of everybody's mouth has to be, what the hell happened?
You know, I think that shortly after the election, I said to myself and our team, you know, let's stop trying to make sense of something that I think just doesn't make sense to us internally. And let's just focus on the future and what we're going to do to continue to get our message out, to continue to support other candidates. And that includes supporting Betty Jean Alexander. You know, I've said from the beginning that this job is bigger than just me as mm-hmm. an individual, and that, you know, serving as a member of the House or a member of the Senate, it's what I do. It's not who I am. And so, you know, this is the will of the people. I support that. I support my next state senator. And just want to make sure that we're going to continue to move forward in a positive way and in a way that continues to lift up other good candidates across the state.
But folks would instantly think, okay, so he must not have done anything.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, he must have just took this for granted. She didn't even lift a finger to spend any money. So you must not have done anything.
Well, yeah, the Monday morning quarterbacking, you know, as I think a natural reaction to, you know, a situation like this. The first thing I would point out is, you know, for the last 4 years, we have always maintained a very hands-on approach to the district, whether it's giving legislative updates at neighborhood associations, block clubs, attending different community events, sponsoring different community events. I hold 5 coffee hours every single month in every single city that I represent. I've done that since I came into the House 6 years ago. And so, you know, one, the notion of not being active and not being involved, obviously I would really reject that. And then on the campaign side of things, you know, we conducted outreach to voters, you know, from my office here on the legislative side of things earlier in the year. We sent out 7 different mailers throughout the course of the year to the voting population. I think what we weren't expecting is the turnout. And I think that's probably where, you know, we might have been caught a little bit blindsided. We had 26,000 voters in this primary in 2014. And I remember at that time, that being a very high watermark. And we ran a absentee ballot chase program. I think most campaigns do that now, where, you know, the absentee ballots go out, we send out a piece of literature to chase that ballot. Right. We ran that program, and what we saw in our district is that absentee ballots were actually down from 2014 to 2018. Statewide, up 200,000 votes. In my district, there was about 400 less absentee ballots. And so, you know, we thought that maybe there wouldn't be that same sort of a trend that was happening in our district. We continued to focus on a universe of about 20,000 voters going into the election. And August 7th came around and 35,000 people showed up to vote. So, you know, I think that again, we could have spent $100,000. We could have won by 20 points. And the topic of this podcast would be, David Kinesic, why did you waste $100,000 to win by 20 points when you could have been out there supporting other Democratic candidates? So, you know, we've supported other Democratic candidates for the last 4 years to the tune of over $200,000 in contributions to the Senate Democratic Caucus. We ran a campaign that I'm proud of. The results just weren't what we had hoped for, and that's okay.
Some would also maybe say that, geez, maybe David Kinesic was just lazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would, again, probably direct folks to, you know, my Facebook, my Twitter, my Instagram, you name it. Not only are we very active in the community, I think we're also pretty active in engaging folks and sharing what we're doing in the community on social media. So, you know, I already touched on a couple of different things that we do. You know, for example, 2 weeks before the election, I mean, we were in North Rosedale Park handing a $150,000 check to the North Rosedale Park Civic Association so that they could redo their community center there. And that's money that I had secured in the budget this year, had worked with my neighborhood association to advance that project with the Republican majority. Then I lost 2-1 2 weeks later in the neighborhood. So, you know, the notion of being lazy or not involved around the community, I really don't think anybody who knows me or knows the district would accept that as fact. I think that, again, it's probably just, you know, some news outlets are looking for their own sensationalized story to get a few headlines.
Have you spoke with Betty Jean Alexander yet?
Haven't spoken to her yet. We've reached out to her and through others to try and have that conversation. Haven't had the conversation yet, but again, that doesn't change any of my approach towards supporting her moving it forward into November. Because again, and I said this in my video on Facebook, Betty's going to be my state senator come January 1st. Mm-hmm. I want her to be successful. I want to have a powerful ally in the legislature here. And so me, my chief of staff, my front deskers, my deputies, we want to do everything that we can to ensure a smooth transition between now and then, because we want her to be able to hit the ground running in January.
How about Lamar Lemons? Have you talked with him yet?
We've reached out to Lamar as well. Haven't had any conversations with him. But again, want to make sure that we can do everything we can to support him.
All right. So you have, what, 4 months left in this term. What do you want to get done
in these next four?
I think more than anything, we want to send a message that, you know, whether you win or whether you lose, that there's a certain type of commitment, I think, that comes with this job. There's a certain type of passion that you need to have when you're doing this job. And so more than anything, I plan on leaving the same way that I came into it, working hard, trying to support other Democrats. When we come back in November, obviously we have a few bills that are in the committee process right now that we'd love to move through the committee process, you know, whether it's repealing the tampon tax or the pension tax or others. But then again, too, working on the appropriation side of things. We have a supplemental budget that's coming up in December. Would love to continue to work that on behalf of my constituents as well. And then being plugged in anywhere else that the Senate Democratic leadership would like to have me.
So come 2019, mm-hmm. do you see yourself wanting to stay in the Lansing area as far as like work, whether it's staff work or lobbying or anything of that nature? Or do you think you want to try something else for a little bit?
Yeah, that's a good question because I get asked that a lot. You know, I think more than anything, I know and I understand that it would be difficult to walk away from my constituents more than anything. You know, folks who put their trust and their faith in me for these last 6 years and who are, frankly, expecting me to stay involved in some capacity. I don't know what that capacity is yet because we're still focused on the job that we have immediately here in front of us. But it's also not lost on me that come January 1st, I'm going to need a new job and I'm going to have to be moving into a different role. So, you know, if there's an opportunity to continue to work with folks here in Lansing, I think that would be awesome. If there's an opportunity to continue to be involved locally as well, I think that that would be great. But I know that on the whole, there's just no way that I could walk away from, you know, the relationships that we've built and the memories that we've made these last couple of years.
And how old are you?
I'm 32.
Isn't that great?
You know, I was talking to somebody the other day that, you know, if we decide to try and run for office again in the future, that'd probably be 4 years at the earliest. I'd be 36 years old. The average age of the legislature in Michigan is 51. Yeah. So I could have served for 6 years, taken a forced four-year leave of absence, and then come back into the game, God willing, and still be 15 years younger than the average. So I think more than anything, this is going to be an opportunity to really take stock of life and am I in the place that I'm supposed to be in? Am I doing the things I'm supposed to be doing? And are there other ways that I can continue to give back to the community as well? And so, you know, on the whole, it may be a blessing in disguise in some way, shape, or form. But I know that, as you pointed out, I'm still young. I've got a lot of passion. I've got a lot of conviction about this state. And I plan on staying involved in the next couple of years.
I remember seeing the first results come out of Wayne County. And I saw Betty Jean Alexander up on you. I thought for sure that a machine had broken or this was a misprint. In fact, I ignored it because I couldn't believe it could be accurate in any way. What was your first thought when you started seeing these results come in?
I knew that we were going to lose when I saw the first precinct come in. And I knew it. We had just finished, you know, sort of wrapping up the campaign operation, making sure that the poll workers were, you know, wrapping things up and heading to where they needed to be. And I saw the first results come in from a precinct in Redford Township. This was a precinct that I had won with 50% of the vote 4 years ago. And so, you know, there was six candidates in our race 4 years ago. And this particular precinct, I had taken 150 of 300 votes.
Oh, wow.
And this particular precinct on August 7th, I won 300 votes. I doubled the amount of votes that I took 4 years ago. And I lost the precinct 350 to 300. And so, you know, as an incumbent, when you see numbers like that coming in, where you are increasing your share of the vote, you know, precipitously, you know, doubling it, but you're still losing, immediate red flags went off. And I was sitting around a table, and I think my chief of staff, Mike wasn't there, but I was talking with Jim Ananick, talking with Curtis Hertel, talking with Brandon Dillon, and I looked across the table, and I said, guys, I'm going to lose tonight. And everybody laughed, and they said, there's just no way. Come on, there's no way. I said, I'm telling you right now, I'm seeing it in this first precinct that just reported. It's just not going to work out for us tonight. And so we knew from the get-go that we were toast.
So what was your first thought then?
I don't know if I had a thought. I mean, we were definitely in disbelief. I was sensitive to the fact that I was surrounded by supporters and staff, and so that it would be important for me to sort of project you know, that this is not getting under my skin or not getting to me. You know, you have this notion of, you know, I need to be strong for the people around me. Mm-hmm. And so For me, it was staying positive. What we ended up doing that night when we wrapped up was going around to other campaigns to check in on them. You know, we went to visit Stephanie Chang, we went to visit Dan Senters, we went to visit all these other campaigns to see how they were doing. And, you know, letting folks know that we may not come out on top that day, but it's not going to discourage any of the involvement that I have, to me, was a very important message to send. And, you know, to be forthright with you, it can be difficult sometimes because, you know, losing an election is never easy. But I also think that the same way that you try to win an election with class and with dignity, that's the same type of way that you need to lose an election as well. And so that, for me, was, you know, sort of on the mind and a priority of how I needed to be conducting myself that evening.
Last thing I wanted to ask you, sure. Mayor Mike Duggan, how do you think he's been doing as a mayor of Detroit?
You know, the mayor and I obviously have some policy disagreements on auto no fault. But on the whole, I've been very pleased with the type of work that Mayor Duggan's been doing in the city of Detroit. I mean, we have seen turnarounds, even in the simplest of things, whether it's lighting or trash pickup, economic development. We've seen a lot of positivity coming out of the city of Detroit. As somebody who represents Northwest Detroit, I would say that I'd like to see more of that attention and that investment and that development come within the neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that, you know, $10 million downtown may move the ball, you know, 10 yards up the field, $10 million in the neighborhood could really be a Hail Mary pass or a home run hit if we're sticking with that analogy. And so, you know, paying more attention to the neighborhoods, understanding that the folks in the neighborhoods, people talk a lot about, you know, Detroit's rebirth, Detroit's resistance, or, you know, renaissance. And I think that that kind of, you know, is a narrative that leaves out the individuals who have been here from the beginning, who have been invested in the city through its brightest days and its darkest days. And so downtown's doing great. I want to see more investment in the neighborhoods. And then, you know, on the issue of auto insurance, I'd definitely like to see the mayor stand up to the auto insurance industry, who are the main problems, I believe, behind the issue of auto insurance, as opposed to trying to take on all these other entities that I don't think have anything to do with the problem. In my conversations across the district, residents tell me, David, I want lower auto insurance. They don't tell me I want less benefits. Mm-hmm. They say I want more affordable auto insurance. And to say that the only way that we can get cheaper auto insurance is to by slashing benefits, to me, is probably the least creative approach that somebody could take.
Do you think he was a political winner on August 7, Mayor Duggan?
Yeah, I think that that'll be decided when we come back into session in January. I know the mayor had some victories in different races that he was playing in. I know that he had some losses as well. Whether or not the members of the legislature are going to, you know, sort of follow the agenda that he might lay out for Lansing in 2019 is yet to be said. I think that if Governor Whitmer is in the governor's office come January 19, that also plays a significant role in what could happen for the mayor's likelihood of success or failure in Lansing.
Excellent. David Kinesic, State Senator, 5th District. Appreciate the time.
Always. Thanks for having me.
All right, that's going to do it for this edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to Senator Kinesic for taking some time with us, Angela for setting it up, John, Jack, and Mike. So as you were listening to that interview, Jack, what did you think?
Well, it's funny because it reminded me of a TV show I watched on the history of baseball, and they were talking to and about Fred Snodgrass.
Fred Snodgrass.
He dropped an easy fly ball in the 1912 World Series and was generally blamed for the Giants losing the World Series because of it. And it's kind of like, you know, what can you say afterward? You can say all this stuff about I did this or I did that. He made a great catch, apparently, the next play. But nonetheless, what can you say other than, hey, I dropped it? And that's all Kinesic can really say is, hey, I didn't win.
It's kind of like Bill Buckner with the ball going in between his legs in the 1986 World Series, and the Mets ended up winning because of that.
Well,
and that's what Bill Buckner's always remembered for, is screwing up the ground ball. Okay, so I'd never heard of Snodgrass before. But here I just looked up the New York Times because I'd never heard this story before. And this is his obit in the New York Times from 1974.
Now, before you read this, did he say
that the only thing that's going to be mentioned as obit was his drop ball?
Yeah, that's what he said afterward.
He's a successful politician and businessman in California, right?
Yeah.
And what did he say? He said the only thing that's going to be mentioned. Now, read the obit.
All right, Ventura, California, April 5, 1974. Fred Carlisle Snodgrass, who muffed an easy fly that helped to cost the New York Giants the 1912 World Series, died today at the age of 86. Not that they don't remember this in New York or anything, right? Snodgrass played 9 years in Major League Baseball with the Giants and the Boston Braves before moving to California, where he became the mayor of Oxnard, a banker and a rancher. But then the next paragraph is all about this play, how he screwed up this fly ball.
And he was on this planet for 86 years, and it's something that happened in half a second.
Yep. Wow. All right. Well,
hopefully that won't be the lead of Kinesic's obituary.
Yeah, I think he made it clear here at the end of the interview that he is going to probably be running again and will probably make up for it. So he's got many years to make up for it.
He didn't have nearly as many people rooting for him as the Giants did, I'm quite sure.
And he doesn't have the New York media to contend with,
That's true.
The New York media can be very unforgiving of such things, as the Boston media is, as well with Bill Buckner. All right, that's going to do it for this week's edition. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.
Thank you.